Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to the wonderful folks from Assistance Dogs of the West. I'm happy now to welcome Stephen Wall. He's chair of the Indigenous Liberal Studies Department at IAIA, the Institute of American Indian Arts here in Santa Fe, and he's chair of the board of SWIA. And Jason Silverman joins us as well. He's the director of the CCA Cinematheque. He's an adjunct teacher at IAIA as well. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And we're here to talk about an event which is part of the Native Cinema Showcase that's happening tonight at 7:30 at the CCA. And it's about, well, it's called From the Archives, Pop Goes the Indian. It's about how Hollywood films and films in general have depicted Native American people. And it's pretty crazy. You go back to the beginning, Buster Keaton and the silent films forward.
Yeah, and actually, we start before that, too. We actually start somewhere around the birth of the photograph, the birth of mass media. And the idea of the program is to explore the intersection between pop culture, Native representation, and American policy, and also issues like empire. We're going to explore what's happened with Manifest Destiny since that philosophy was invented in the late 1830s, and it should be fun. We're going to show lots of clips, lots of slides, dozens and dozens of slides of cool stuff, and all kinds of weird and wild Hollywood clips.
So when you look at some of these early depictions of Native people in cinema, what are some of the, Stephen, what are some of the typical stereotypes that come out?
Well, one of the things that I often deal with is people will still, even in the 21st century, ask if Indians still live in teepees. And so we have a whole series of stereotypical images that have been building on each other since probably beginning 1840s, 1850s, 1860s. These images have built on each other. This has become a popular mythology. There hasn't been very much until probably in the 60s and 70s that began to counter those particular stereotypical images. Those include, the teepee, the braids, the big nose, skin tone, those kinds of images, as well as images related to how Indian people act, how they speak, how they carry themselves. There's also stereotypical images in terms of how Indians dance and what Indian music sounds like. All of these things are carried in. We see them now because we have a film process that includes both sound and an image. But in the days of the silent movies, you had mostly the images. But all of those are built on a kind of a carefully constructed, I would almost say a campaign to depict Indian people a certain way, starting in the early 1800s all the way up into the turn of the 20th century.
What was the nature of this campaign?
Well, part of it is that in order to justify taking the land, you had to portray Indian people as not deserving of the land, that somehow they're not using it correctly, somehow they're not, perhaps they're even subhuman, that they don't really understand the way the world really works. And there has to be a popular image of that in order to justify some of the things that were happening to or justified the policies that were created starting in, from the 1830s up until 1930s, 100 years of policy there. And so in order to get people to feel that, well, we're doing the right thing, you have to create these images that reflect Indian people in rather poor light and in a very simplistic light.
it's funny because it really goes, that kind of thing goes to the present. I just today, this morning, happened to be reading an email in which a former governor of Alaska was quoted as saying, and this was in favor of his idea that you should be able to take native land away from natives in Alaska. He was quoted as saying, just because your granddaddy chased a moose across some property doesn't mean you own it.
Well, you know, and that's kind of, in some ways, the same attitudes. That's been going on for quite a while. It may have changed a little bit of its structure, but it's still the very same attitudes.
Now, Jason, film came into popularity considerably after a lot of the Manifest Destiny policies. How do you relate the attitudes in film directly toward those policies? Or is it more just like an ethos that was out there in society?
Well, this, you know, we're also going to give a brief history of the mass media in this lecture, because it seems to me, and Stephen can hopefully bear me out on this, that the more powerful that the tools of mass media became, the more the more influential the kind of messaging that called the master race was able to project. So with photographs, they can be read in certain ways. They're not necessarily as convincing in terms of propaganda as the moving images. I mean, nothing is as convincing as a good movie in terms of, you know, projecting stereotypes. So I think that you'll see when the movies start that the kind of messages that get projected about indigenous people and all kinds of people who are on the margins get stronger and stronger. And it becomes, you know, these movies, inadvertently or not, we think not, become a marketing campaign for a certain kind of way of American, certain kind of American culture and society, the one that often marginalizes the other.
When does it become propaganda? In other words, is there a direct relationship between, as there has been in the history of film, but it's not always there, between filmmakers and government funding and stuff like that?
You know, it may not be a direct connection between government funding, but and filmmakers, because it's, you know, most of these films were produced for popular culture, for mass production and mass consumption, and didn't really connect with the government. But you know, it's not governments. How do you say this? It's not always just the government that has an interest in propaganda. You know, we see that even today when we're dealing with things like oil slicks off of Louisiana, there's propaganda coming out. It's not being promoted by the government. It's being promoted by the people involved, responsible for that. And so what we see then is a kind of a convergence of interests, that there's a whole lot of folks who have an interest in certain kinds of policies, and if you can create the mass media image that you want, then you can move forward with that policy, and you don't have to be a government to create the propaganda.
One of the things that I noticed when looking at some of these clips from the older films and some not so old films is that you've got a couple of really standout things. One is the brutal savage, and one is the noble, kind of romanticized wise man, mm-hmm. which seem to kind of be at odds with each other.
Well, that goes to the whole schizophrenic perspective that most of America has towards Native people. You know, there has to be some level of representation of those things that justify the taking of the land, such as the brutal savagery. At the same time, you also have a recognition that there's some other things here. Maybe there's some validity to what these guys have to say, and so you have basically two opposing concepts, and they both get a little bit of play. I think there's more play on the side of the of the brutal savage than there is in terms of the wise wise Indian person, but even then, you're still dealing with stereotypes. You're still casting what essentially here, at least in the lower 48, is close to 300 different tribes as the same, you know, monocultural. You know, this is the same person. Same, every one tribe's the same as the other, which is certainly not true. And there's the media, the mass media in particular, doesn't have room to deal with tribes individually, so they end up stereotyping them, which ends up causing all kinds of problems as we go through just as we go through these things.
Stephen, you're a professor at IAIA. Mm-hmm. You've got Native students from all over the certainly all over the U.S. and beyond. And what kind of effect do those stereotypes have on Native people themselves?
Well, people get real tired of it, for one thing. You know, there's a real there's a real struggle because there's identity issues that come about that are I don't see it so much. I'll be honest with you, I see it in a lot of different places, but I've also worked for many, many years in many different tribal organizations and tribal situations before I came to IA, and I've seen tribal people trying to live up to the stereotypical view that America has on them. And we don't see that so much today here at IA, but we do see people with a lot of concern and a lot of confusion about identity. And it plays out in quite a number of different ways.
What does that look like?
What does that look like?
Yeah, and out in the world, people trying to live up to some concept of themselves.
Well, you know, a lot of times people are wanting to be they want to be either the brutal savage, and they do things that are I would say negative, simply to fulfill that particular stereotype. There's people who go around really promoting themselves as that wise Indian stereotype that you had talked about earlier. There's people who really set themselves up as being somebody who meets that popular expectation of what a person like that would be like. You know, so, you know, we see these things. And, luckily, not as much as perhaps as the past, but we still do see them. And it's unfortunate.
It's a funny thing in a place like Santa Fe too. I knew somebody who was a Native South American man who was in no way a shaman, but there were all these ladies in Santa Fe who were sort of trying to get him to be their shaman.
And and did he turn them down? No.
No, he did turn them down.
Oh, he did. Good.
He told me once. He said to me, Mary Charlotte, I could have made so much money.
Oh yeah, I mean that's part of the stereotype, and that's kind of in some ways, you know, seeing people in this very shallow, one-dimensional type of thing that's not even created by that person, but is created by, you know, mass media as a result of movies and as a result of, you know, the expectations that are created in the media. We're seen as these one-dimensional people who fit this particular person's fantasy of some sort, and that's not very healthy for anybody.
I was watching Democracy Now! Once, and there was a man who had made, I think he'd written a book and made a film called Real, R-E-E-L, Real Bad Arabs, and it was about the depiction of Middle Eastern, you know, Arabic people in the speaking people in the movies, and you could do the same thing for African American people and all sorts of things. It's sort of wherever you go, you encounter that problem of stereotyping.
Well, you know, it's the lazy man's way of dealing with things. On one hand, individuals have we as individuals have the authority within ourselves to find out the real truth about who another person is or what another culture is. But a lot of times, if we accept the stereotypes uncritically, then we're really exposing ourselves as kind of lazy and not wanting to find out really what people are like, and it kind of creates us as if we refuse to deal with our own view of the stereotypes, if we refuse to deal with that responsibly, it shows us as being pretty shallow. At the same time, having these stereotypes does fulfill some people's policy interests, whether it's business policy or governmental policy or whatever. If you can show people to be an unworthy other, then you're in some ways, you're given, you know, the authority you need to do what you want to if it involves doing something negatively to that group, regardless of what that group is. We see it in, we've seen it in relation to Islam, and we've seen it in relation to the Palestinians. We see it in relation to a whole lot of folks, not just American Indians. We just happen to be one of those people who's on that list of others.
Stephen, do you think, Mary Charlotte and I were talking about this before, do you think that indigenous people are a special case in terms, not that it's a competition to see who's been more caricatured by the media, but it seems, and I've studied this a bit, as you know, it seems as though because of the issues of empire and the land and, it seems more systemic in terms of American media portrayals and indigenous people than it has, against, for example, African Americans or Arabs, which now there's, of course, a justification for stereotyping. There's some sort of justification for stereotyping because of, the so-called war on terror, et cetera. But it seems like indigenous people are in a special place in terms of how they've been portrayed by the media.
Well, I don't know that that we particularly enjoy a special place. The thing that we enjoy is the longevity in which we've been depicted. Depictions of us go back a long, long ways, and in some way we were the first other, at least in terms of there of course were others before us, starting with the Crusades primarily, looking from the Western perspective, anybody who's not Western European or Western European based is somebody else. And starting with the Crusades, we start seeing a definite relationship to the other. It just seems like we've had a longer period of time that we've actually been in the spotlight, so to say. And also, the issues you raise in terms of empire, in terms of assimilation, in terms of resources. There's a whole lot of policy reasons there that we still remain in the limelight, so to say. I don't think that any depiction of us is any more better or any more worse than depictions of any of the others that the West has chosen to depict negatively.
We're talking to Stephen Wall of IAIA and Jason Silverman of the CCA here in Santa Fe. So at a certain point, Native people started making films about themselves and their lives. And also at a certain point, various civil rights movements happened and the white filmmaking and artistic establishment got more educated and more less ignorant about what was going on around them. What are some films, and I'd like to ask this to both of you, that you think give a really interesting and nuanced and non-stereotyped view of Native people?
Well, it's kind of tough. I mean, one of the things, here, at least here in the United States, and this is not necessarily a knock on Native filmmakers, but here in the United States, we have a certain genre, I guess you would say, of Native films. And to a certain degree, a lot of Native filmmakers have not gone very far from the more enlightened non-Indian filmmakers of the 60s and 70s and 80s. But for me, my favorite film that really breaks away from all of that is a Canadian film called Dance Me Outside. And it really does not pander to any kind of stereotype or anything like that. It's really a good story. And maybe it's because it's coming from Canada. Maybe it's refreshing to me because of that. but I've seen some of the films. I've just, to a certain degree, I haven't seen the ultimate Indian film yet, let's put it that way, except the closest I would say is Dance Me Outside. But there's a lot of new stuff coming out, and I'll admit I haven't been keeping up that closely, but that's my general response to that.
Jason, what about you?
I think we're well into the first generation of filmmakers that of Native filmmakers that have not felt that they needed to make films specifically about resistance to white culture, and so I think Dance Me Outside is one good example. The Fast Runner is another great one. There's a new Australian film called Samson Delilah that'll be out later this year that's really powerful. Chris Eyre does good work in the context of the kind of commercial system, and there's a lot of filmmakers who are making interesting stuff. I think the next 5 or 10 years are going to be seeing some really amazing stuff, not just from North American indigenous filmmakers, but around the world. There's there's a lot of interesting stories to tell that are really relevant to a larger audience, and they have the means to do it, which is new.
I think one thing that also really came to mind when I was looking at this reel of just clips from Hollywood films in which Native people are depicted in one way or another was that there is a kind of subtext that you can discern in these films, which is that a lot of people who come from whatever their industrialized country or city or situation is, and they don't have a connection to the food that they eat, and they don't have a connection to the air that they breathe and things like that, are looking to any indigenous culture whatsoever in order to reconnect to something which is fundamentally human. And there probably is a grain of goodness and sincerity in that, and at the same time, you can very quickly get to romanticize people and not see them clearly in that quest to reconnect to the earth and to one's own human roots.
And that may be one of the things you asked earlier about the specialness of Indians, or maybe Jason asked me, in terms of this representation, and that may be one of the things that is the reason we've been, so often brought into the media. There's tons and tons of cultural groups here in America that number in the same amounts as Native Americans, or even more. You very seldom see them in that realm of representation. I mean, they're just totally overlooked, and so that mystique is still there. And for a lot of people, for a lot of Native people, that connection is still very, very real. And it may be that just some of the filmmakers and a lot of the audiences are continually trying to connect with Indian people through the movies because of that. Jason?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's it goes back to the question that is really at the heart of all of these conversations, is who gets to tell these stories? And what's their motivation for telling them in the way they're telling them? And, so when you talk about the romanticization of it, it is, those end up being critiques on American culture often, more often than not. It's often, Native people in the films of the 60s and 70s, in Billy Jack or Little Big Man, they end up being about providing... using the Native American as a kind of canvas that serves as an alternative depiction of what American society could look like. Here's the brutal American society, and here's the peaceful, natural alternative.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Well, all this and much more we will be discussing tonight at the CCA. It's an event which is, what is it, Jason? It's a conversation between the two of you and a lot of media.
And it's the first part of a 4-part series that we're doing this spring and summer to gear up for the 10th annual Native Cinema Showcase. That's our festival that happens during Indian Market, that's produced by the CCA, the Smithsonian National Museum of the American Indian, and SWIA. And of course, SWIA is the wonderful producer of Indian Market. And for this will be the third year that SWIA is building a tent at Cathedral Park right downtown so we can show films. We show them for free there. So we're really grateful for that partnership.
Well, it's very important, and I hope lots of students and young people come to this, because it really is educational when you see these things all in a row, these kinds of media, to think about them, because when they're in the context of a movie like Peter Pan or something, they kind of blend in. Not that I'd even seen the animated Peter Pan, but you might not notice them because you're so busy watching the plot of the movie. So very, very interesting, and we look forward to seeing you both tonight at the CCA.
Great.
Thank you.
Stephen Wall, once again, is the Chair of Indigenous Liberal Studies at IAIA, and Jason Silverman, Director of the CCA Cinematheque. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in just a moment. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'm very happy now to welcome Carolyn Clark Beadle. She is Executive Director of Assistance Dogs of the West. Alex Johansson is a dog trainer with that wonderful organization who is with us here. And Jane Bernard is a photographer, including a dog photographer. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
It's great to have you. It's been a while. Well, I guess we had you on last year, shortly before Assistance Dogs of the West graduation, which this year is happening on Tuesday, the 18th of May at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. Tell us about Assistance Dogs. What do Assistance Dogs do?
Mary Charlotte, assistance dogs are a particular type of very highly trained dog that work with people with physical, emotional, and developmental disabilities. So not to be confused with guide dogs that work with people that have visual impairments, or hearing dogs that work with people who have hearing impairments. So there are three major categories of dogs. Assistance dogs have been being trained here in the United States for probably between 35 and 40 years, and they have evolved to help lots of different kinds of disabilities over time as people look at what these amazing animals can do and understand that we could ask them to do a little bit more.
So there are, in your typical assistance dog, you have a lot of, what, retrievers?
Labrador retrievers and golden retrievers tend to be the breed of choice for the industry, and it kind of makes sense in that of the 400 plus breeds of dogs, those dogs went out to fetch something and bring it back to their owner with a soft mouth. So if we started assistance dogs to help people with physical mobility challenges and they needed to pick lots of things up and bring them back to people, that was a perfect choice.
Give us an example of somebody with, for example, mobility problems that uses an assistance dog and what their day is like and the role of that dog in their day.
The dog wakes up with them because the dog's pretty much on the same schedule as the person. The dog is probably going to fetch them whatever they need in the morning, be it clothes, shoes, or even help. Some people, they need help like getting out of bed. So the dog can be a brace or help clothe them. And then from there, whatever the person...
The dog can help clothe them?
They can hold a pant leg up or something, and then they can slip their leg if they're unable to do that for themselves. And the dog can also help undress the person, as they can just grab a sleeve of a shirt and pull it off.
Interesting point. I don't know how many dogs have colorblind issues, and you might look a little funny depending on if you let them pick your outfit.
I'm sure you can tell them what to get. I'm sure there's a little... easy ways to get around that.
Maybe you could color code it with meat smells.
This is just getting absurd.
Anyway, and so as the person goes through the day, what are some other things that the dog does?
First of all, the dog's going to help them be out in public, because we, as Carolyn said, we do have a lot of golden retrievers for that. There's that social barrier between people, because everyone's had a golden retriever and known one. But when you see, say, a German Shepherd or something, or even them by themselves, you're going to be more intimidated. That's why we choose these dogs that people are accustomed to, so they might go up, pet the dog, converse with these people that they would never, they usually
ignore. Interesting. I thought you weren't supposed to pet somebody's assistance dog.
You're not supposed to, but people still can come up, and you can ask to pet a dog, and then if they give it, but it gives you that more incentive to talk to these people when most of the time you might just ignore them or walk away from them.
You know, one of the clients that I photographed with their dog said something really sweet. She said, "My dog opens doors for me in so many ways." So he literally helps her open doors as she's coming and going, but also she was in a wheelchair, she had MS, and as she became more and more debilitated, it was harder and harder for her emotionally to be out in public. And she said, with the dog, it started conversations, and instead of people being focused on her disability, they were focused on the dog, which was a wonderful thing for her. She said it gave her great confidence to
be
out in public.
That actually could work us into the different kinds of dogs that Assistance Dogs of the West trains, because there is a specialty kind of dog that is working with people with psychiatric diagnoses.
And so the dog will say, tell me why you feel that way.
If his name is Freud, yes. But that's, you know, few and far between. But what happens, though, as Jane is pointing out, is so many of our clients, it is heartwarming and heart-filling to hear what dogs can do, because we are training them to do specific tasks. 50% of what the dog brings to their human partner is the task. 50% is the unconditional love, 24/7 relationship that we, many of us who have pets, understand and get out of this special bond that develops. So one of our recent psychiatric support dogs went to an individual with high panic anxiety, high depression, and almost, you know, borderline personality disorder. We, you know, don't need to define these kinds of things, but literally could not go out in public. And so what she said with tears in her eyes was, I have a huge part of my life back by virtue of having Fiona working with me, because all those places that scared me, the, you know, I have a friend, I have a companion, I have a barrier. So it's a really interesting thought that what they do besides the task.
Alex, how do you train a dog to be a psychiatric assistance dog?
I think some of it kind of comes natural, because if the dog likes the person, they're going to be more inclined to support them in that way. And as we all know, if we have a pet, they can pretty much tell what kind of mood you're in. And if you're upset or you're down, the dog, or sometimes a cat even, but in this case a dog, is going to go over and try to its best to make you happy, whether that's try to get you out of bed for a walk. There's going to be the incentive to leave your house instead of just be a ball of mush in your bed. And in other ways, the dog, I don't know, I think I don't think you can really train it. I think it is just a natural thing that comes out of it.
Well, one of the training connections that we do make is like panic anxiety and or really clinical depression when it's extreme, the dog recognizes that behavior. And so there can be an alert that is trained to, okay, Alex, you know what, you're getting to that scary place. The behavior is starting to look like that, therefore you want to go get someplace safe, so that you can go have your panic anxiety attack if you're going to, you know, someplace safe instead of at the Santa Fe Baking Company.
Now, which is a very dangerous place. Now, the dogs, some of the dogs you have are for people with autism.
Correct. That's an interesting evolution that I'm going to say has taken place in the last 10 years. Now, you know, there are so many scary figures out there about autism. And in the United States, there is a figure that one in somewhere between 150 and 200 children born has somewhere on the autism disorder spectrum. So there's lots of different varieties of that. But what has happened because of these numerous children that have these the challenge, which tends to be relative to any kind of transitions. Sensory transitions are very, very difficult. So sounds and new places and new faces are really difficult to work through. And what happens in the placement of an autism support dog, the child starts to develop a relationship with the animal that has no, you know, minimal transitional activity. It's always a dog, and it's always your friend, and it's always going to be there, and it's not talking to you. So the relationship and the abilities that develop, the skills and abilities and behaviors with the child and the dog, then start to become generalized out into the public. We have a placement that one dog went to a set of twins that were little girls that were nonverbal, very difficult to deal, not going to school.
Both autistic,
7 years old. And the dog placement, they started talking to the dog. You can't say the dog did it, but the parent will say, my children did not speak. But
the dog created a safe space for the child.
It's the relationship, yeah. I mean, it's that kind of even. And safe is one word, but I don't want it to kind of be... at any rate, you know, when you think about what that does, the other thing that many children with autism will do is they've got high energy, very high energy, and there's a lot of darting. And so there's a bracing ability with a leash to the belt of the child.
Oh.
Dog and child don't usually, until they get older and depending on what their development is, they're not alone. So the placement with autism support dogs is usually a family placement. And
So the dog is keeping the child on a leash instead of vice versa?
Correct. Yeah, and also, if there's this whole darting kind of thing where a child learns that, you know, dog's going to pull back when it darts, and so it stops with the darting.
Right, it's a behavioral
change.
Modification.
Correct.
We're talking about the Assistance Dogs of the West. Years ago, I read a long article about Temple Grandin, who is an autistic woman who ended up getting a PhD and is absolutely brilliant. And she found a stronger relationship with cows than with other human beings. She related to them, she understood them. And I wonder whether autism doesn't have as one of its, I thought after that, as one of its qualities, that people who have it sometimes relate better to animals than to other people.
Autism is so broad in it's called a disorder spectrum or spectrum disorder, in that there is such a continuum and different kinds of people in different places along that, and we don't know enough about it, and I am so not an expert about autism. So we don't know enough about it to be able to really make generalizations. Temple Grandin continues to do great work with animals, and she is an enormous educator when it comes to that kind of connection. And the net out of this is the brain is so incredibly complex, as we all know, that there are different parts that work with different individuals.
So we have people working with dogs, working with people who have psychiatric disorders, with autism, with mobility problems of various kinds. You also have dogs working with people who regularly get seizures, who have seizure disorders.
Yes, we do. And that's a very interesting and important relationship, in that depending on the person's seizure disorder challenge, dogs will be trained. All dogs are trained to respond. So they will recognize when it occurs. And sometimes they are trained specifically on tasks to perform to pull the person out of the seizure. Sometimes people's seizures last for extended periods of time, and a dog could be licking the face or doing something to help the person come out of the seizure. Then post.
Really?
Yeah. And that's specific. In all of our training, when the dog is matched with the individual, the specifics are finished, if you will. So the dogs all learn the standard 90 commands, which is outrageously intense. And then as they get their human partner, what the human partner's needs are translated into the specific tasks that each dog will perform. So dogs can help pull the person out of the seizure, and then they help with... After the seizure, there's a whole lot of retrieval, balance, bracing activity that it is required, you know, could be required.
Do they call 911?
They can if there's a 911 on the phone. Seriously?
Really?
There's a 911 button on many phones for people with disabilities, and dogs are trained to hit the 911 button.
Really?
Yeah.
So you train them, Alex, to do that?
Yep. They can also get a phone if it doesn't have a 911 button. But going back to what Carolyn was saying about how the end of the right as that placement time, that's where the dog gets the specialized commands. They also learn that even after placement, because the dog I just finished training, Jackson, he went to someone, and on his own ability, he has been able to detect seizures and starting to alert the family on them. And that was something seizures that we hadn't quite. We didn't fully train that in while we trained him. He just started doing that on his own with the family.
So the point there is there's no guarantee that a dog who is working with a seizure person will alert to the onset of seizures. So that means it's giving the person some pre-warning that there is a seizure coming on. There is no guarantee. Right now, 100% of the dogs that we have placed with people with seizure disorders alert. And that gets back to the relationship that the animal has with the person and that astounding observational skill that dogs have. So they're watching us. because there are, you know, we are their people. And when they see that strange behavior, they're going to start doing an alert.
What abilities do dogs have that are stronger than human beings have that help them be assistance dogs?
I would say scent. That would be the biggest one, because that doesn't just help for any one ability of training. It's for everything. Seizure alert, diabetic alert, anything. And then also there's something about safety, that knowing that there's, because whenever someone is around a house, that people with dogs are going to feel a little safer. And if you're in a city, you're going to know that the dog is going to be able to smell or hear anyone that comes up, so you'll know in advance. That's just a little thing to just reassure someone at the home front, so to speak.
There are phrases in the language like, you could smell fear. Can dogs really smell things like that? Can they smell when somebody's, for example, dangerous in some way?
There's so much chemical change in the human body that is related to scent. And the number of, you know, multiplier of the dog's ability to smell as compared to the humans is 250,
something like
450
that.
Yeah, times
it's
our
ridiculous.
Ability. It is quantum in its, you know, its scope. So it dogs, and that's why, you know, when you think about your dog going out on the walk and you get a little irritated because it's sniffing at everything, that is heaven, because they have these, plus
huge
dogs,
olfactories.
They smell out of both sides that we don't. We're smelling out of one. They smell out of both nostrils.
Oh, so they have
nostrils.
They can tell what direction.
Binostral
yeah. Isn't
smelling.
Directional smell.
Who knew?
Who knew? It's so fascinating the more you learn about what these abilities are. And then, once again, how do you place them in service to people? What's happening is people who have needs that have seen dogs working in other, you know, to support other disabilities say, well, you know, could you help me with whatever it is? I wanted to go back one second to, we talked about the psychiatric support dogs. A big, huge challenge right now is PTSD from our returning veterans. And that's gigantic. And they're learning. So dogs are being trained to pop the corner or, you know, look at the perimeter. Seriously, to follow what the behaviors were that have created some of the anxiety in the veterans. So the dog, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you think that you're being bombed or that there's an IED around the corner and your dog is sitting there sleeping, you know you're okay.
Yeah.
There's so many little subtle things that go into this. And the question about, you know, what besides scent, what do dogs have? Dogs have the strongest animal relationship with humans. And so they have learned to watch us in a way that we don't watch people with the same level.
One of the terrible and sad problems of post-traumatic stress disorder and combat trauma and all of that is that sometimes people come back and they abuse the people they love the most. Have you had any problems with people abusing dogs?
In the world of placing dogs with returning veterans, we're learning as an industry. And what we found is it takes a while to get to a place of stability, emotional and life stability, to be able to have those kind of relationships. So dogs that are placed with people that are in their first year of returning, it's not necessarily successful. And so we are not doing that any longer. We're waiting. And there are a lot of questions that are asked. In the application process to become a client with any service dog agency, and particularly with Assistance Dogs of the West, we ask a whole lot of questions that get around how do you deal with fear, anger, so that we know, because it's not going to be successful and it certainly isn't going to be healthy to have a relationship if you don't have the ability to do it.
So the Assistance Dogs of the West graduation is a week from today. It's Tuesday, the 18th of May at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Community Convention Center. And one of the wonderful things that you all are doing together is you're not only making it a community event, but you're bringing in community support. And one of the wonderful ways that you're doing that is with Jane Bernard, who is sitting here with us. You are a dog photographer, and I'm sorry that we can't show your work here on the air, because it is absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. Dog
portraits, yeah, whatever, you know, all dogs are cute, you take a picture. These are beautiful dog portraits.
Well, thank you. I really enjoy, and actually, I'm really a documentary photographer, and I have, over the years, photographed the clients and the dogs of Assistance Dogs of the West pro bono for ADW. So it's not something that I've really done much of other than for Assistance Dogs of the West. I guess you could say my specialty is photographing people, but I'm a huge dog lover, and I've always taken lots of pictures of my own dogs. And what I look for when I am photographing a dog is I'm trying to show its personality, its quirks, its what's playful, what's unique, what's interesting about that animal, which is something that I've always used when photographing people.
And so what are you doing with assistance dogs right now?
Well, I am volunteering my services.
We love that.
I wanted to help them with their fund drive. So if people donate a certain amount of money, one of the things that they will receive at no cost is a portrait setting of their dog for free and a 5x7 portrait. And it helps Assistance Dogs of the West.
Very nice.
So I wanted to think of a creative way to help the organization and hopefully drive a little buzz and get people excited about donating money.
Yeah.
I feel like they're really a phenomenal organization because not only are they working with people with disabilities and with dogs, but they're also working with kids. They teach kids how to train the assistance dogs. It's part of their program. So they're very... it's almost a multidisciplinary approach to helping the community.
What is it like for you? You've been training dogs, Alex, since you were 12 years old. You just turned 18.
Yep.
6 years worth of dog training. What have you learned? What are some of the main skills that you have as a dog trainer?
Patience is a big thing, and being able to read the dog. That's another thing. Not only can I read dogs better from 6 years, I've noticed things in people's body motion, because when you're training a dog, you have to know when they're stressed out, if there's something wrong, how they hold their tail. All this stuff tells you what they're feeling at any given time, so you can be more successful for a training with a dog.
We have every year probably about 250 kids in 18 different programs across the state of New Mexico, mostly central, Albuquerque, Santa Fe, and up into Rio Riba County. And one of the things I want to give big accolades to Alex is there are people that have been student trainers that have been involved in the program that demonstrate a certain level of commitment and talent and skill. And those, there are a handful of them at any given time, and we give some of these student trainers teaching assistant positions, and that turns them into peer coaches and mentors to student trainers, which when you stop and think about it, here they're learning how to learn, and then they're learning how to teach. So they've learned how to learn, they've learned how to train, they learned how to teach. And also that ability to, and I'm going to say, you know, you're a teenager, you can be a pain, but working with your peers and with some of the younger student trainers that are in there, there is a compassion level, not only compassion for the folks with disabilities where the dogs are going to go, but a higher level of compassion and patience, however, whatever words you want to use, for people of your own age group. And the progression, evolution, whatever, the abilities that you guys, the Alexes of the world, and as I say, there's only a handful, what they demonstrate every year is inspiring. You want to say, good job.
Thank you.
Jane Bernard, what is your website?
Well, you can look at my dog portraits at janebernard.com/dogs with a capital D, lowercase, O-G-S. And I would encourage people to come to the graduation if they don't know much about the organization. It's a really, really special, heartwarming, especially in these times where there's so much bad news out there. This is good news.
And you will take a picture of their dog
if they make a donation.
Excellent. Carolyn Clark Beadle is Executive Director of Assistance Dogs of the West. Alex Johansson is a dog trainer with that group. And Jane Bernard is a photographer. And once again, on Tuesday, the 18th of May at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Convention Center, Community Convention Center, is the Assistance Dogs of the West graduation, which will be populated by the cutest dogs ever. And if you want to find out more information, you can go to assistancedogsofthewest.org. I shouldn't have said cutest, probably most competent as well as cute.
Pretty much, yeah.
But they're pretty cute.
And Jane's pictures show that.
They certainly do. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my own email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Thanks to Brian Highhill for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.